Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Coming up, a Memorial Day conversation with mothers who share a bond nobody wants, having lost sons in Iraq. But first, in Baghdad, Iran's ambassador to Iraq says he expects there will be more meetings between his country and the U.S. The Iranian ambassador and the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker, met for 4 hours today to discuss the future of Iraq. These are the first formal talks since U.S. broke diplomatic ties with Iran 27 years ago, after Iranian militants held 52 Americans hostage. Well, Leila Fadel is with McClatchy Newspapers in Baghdad. Leila, we know that both sides seem to trade accusations in today's meeting. Is that accurate?
That's true. The U.S. Expressed their concerns about Iranian funding and weapon smuggling to Shia militias here, as well as to a lesser extent to Sunni insurgents as well. They asked them to stop doing this, which they say is counter to the policy that Iran states to keep stability in Iraq. Of course, Iran denied that accusation and lobbed their own accusation asking the Americans to withdraw, which they see as the instability here in Iraq.
Well, in addition to both sides blaming each other for the lack of security in Iraq, we understand Iran wanted to raise the issue of the Mujahideen Khalq. This is the Iranian opposition group, 10,000 strong, based in Iraq. Iran wants them disbanded or even sent back to Iran for punishment. Washington, we understand, considers them a terrorist organization, but U.S. forces protect their encampment in Iraq. Can you tell us what more you know about the group, and was this raised today?
The Iranian ambassador said that he did raise this issue. The Mujahideen Khalq is an anti-Iranian regime group that came to be camped here in Iraq under Saddam Hussein's regime because they were against Iran. They had been accused of helping Saddam Hussein quiet the uprising of the Shia and the Kurds, where thousands of people were killed. Of course, they deny that, and they consider themselves refugees rather than terrorists. They say that they should be allowed to stay here as refugees. The Iraqi government considers them illegal and has asked them to leave their country. And the U.S. has a paradox. It really works in a paradox with them because they protect their encampment. North,
again,
here near the Iranian border.
In addition, we understand that an Iraqi with close ties to Iran, Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, is out of hiding. We understand he came out last week. Since then, his militia has increased its attacks on U.S. forces. Was any of this brought up? Is this part of the U.S. accusation of Iran that it is supporting militias in Iraq?
Neither of the ambassadors referred to any specific militia. Most of the accusations of EFPs explosively formed penetrators, which can penetrate American Humvees, and they call them one of the deadliest forms of IEDs, they say, come from Iran. But mostly they accuse the Mehdi Army, which is Sutter's militia, of using those rogue elements of the Mehdi Army. Neither of the groups said that was brought up itself. This increase in reaction from the Mehdi Army in recent days is actually quite worrying for the Iraqi government. And a lot of Sadrs have told me that they feel that the U.S. is trying to pull the Sadrs back into confrontation with the U.S., whereas the U.S. says they're trying to peacefully, if they could do it peacefully, get rid of these EFPs, get rid of these caches, stop the Iranian funding.
Well, meantime, the Iranian ambassador to Iraq, who again was in this meeting for 4 hours today, has told the Associated Press that he believes the next meeting will occur in Iraq in less than 1 month. You're there in Baghdad. What's your sense? You've been at press conferences today. What's your sense of how this meeting went? What's the tone?
Well, the message from the U.S. ambassador wasn't extremely positive. His tone at the press conference, it felt that there wasn't really much productivity. You know, he said that we went into this meeting not expecting to have more meetings, but to voice our concerns, which he says he didn't get a response to. Of course, the Iranian ambassador also said, we deny that accusation. We want the Americans to come back with evidence. The Iranian ambassador had a more positive tone about future talks with the U.S. He said that he expects that this is a beginning, not an end. He will take what was said today back to Iran. Hopefully there will be future meetings. He didn't reference a time frame when I heard him speak, but he was a little bit more positive in that aspect. He also said he proposed a trilateral security committee, which would have Iraqi, Iranian, and U.S. Officials on it. That's something that the U.S. ambassador said that they would have to study very closely and take back to Washington.
Layla Fidel.
Layla
Fidel, speaking to us from Baghdad. She's with McClatchy Newspapers there in Baghdad on a cell phone, and we thank you for that, Layla.
Thank you.
Well, on this Memorial Day, we have a conversation with two mothers who know a bit about Iraq and share a bond nobody wants. Their sons were killed in that country. Here Now producer Alex Ashlock had planned to bring us a compilation of voices today, a montage of the pain of war. But he soon discovered that these stories are too big for small sound bites. He spoke to June Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan, who lost her son, 26-year-old Army Private William Davis, on March 17th of this year. And Elfriede Plumador of Gresham, Oregon, who lost her boy, 22-year-old Army Sergeant Adam Plumador, on February 16th, 2005. As Alex found out, they wanted to speak to you and to each other. He began by asking Elfriede about Adam.
What was he like as a kid growing up? What kinds of things did he like to do?
Pretty much anything. If it was outdoor, he was very much family-oriented. We spent a lot of time as a family unit together. He rode motorcycles. He had a couple of favorite T-shirts that I kept threatening to throw out because they were just so worn, and he'd go, no, those are my favorite ones, and so I could never had the heart to throw them out, but... So he had a couple of T-shirts that he would wear. He would always wore a cowboy hat most of the time. And he drove a pickup truck and listened to George Strait.
June, your son, William Billy Davis, did you call him Billy?
We called him Billy.
His father served during the Vietnam War, his grandfather during World War II. From what I understand, he always wanted to join the Army. You didn't want him to, but I guess you couldn't stop him.
Nope. He wanted to join at 18. He had a recruiter here, and I kicked the recruiter out, and he still wanted to do it. He had a family, and he wanted to provide well for them, and he wasn't doing too well here job-wise with the economy, and I think he thought this was the best.
What kind of a kid was Billy growing up?
Billy was always a smiley kid. He always had a smile from ear to ear, and he was friends with everybody, and he was a nice kid.
Elfriede, June was saying that Billy wanted to join the Army from an early age. What about Adam? How did he end up in the Army?
I think like typical boys, he and our other son played Army. They would dress in their camo, which was their hunting clothes, but still when they were kids, it was their camo, and they would play Army. My husband, Dan, also served in the Air Force during the end of the Vietnam conflict, and my dad served in Korea. So being a military family just pretty much came naturally, and he wanted a career when he finished in law enforcement, so he thought the military experience would be a definite plus, and serving was just something that our family has done.
He certainly seemed to have the skills to come back to civilian life and do a job like you described. He was a world-class sharpshooter, as I understand it, but that skill kind of put him in a dangerous position when he was in Iraq. Can you tell us how he was killed?
He was a sniper, and the strikers were all on patrol. Adam happened to be out the top center hatch on one of the strikers. They went by a vehicle. Standard operating procedure at that point in time was if there were people around the vehicle, it was considered safe. If there was no one around the vehicle, then they gave it a wide berth or checked it out, you know, more intensively. But this vehicle had four people around it, so as the strikers rolled by, they actually blew the car because it was filled with explosives. They blew it when his striker was pretty much even with it. And being out the hatch, he was susceptible to any shrapnel and stuff that came by, and two small pieces actually missed his helmet, unfortunately, and got him in the side of his head, and it killed him.
You and he talked about your worry about him being exposed in that way. What did he say?
First of all, he tried, you know, to sorry, this can make me cry. He tried to always tell me that he was safer doing what he did because he was always paying attention. But he always told me that, he goes, Mom, I'm a sniper. He goes, this is my job. He goes, the lives of my guys depend on me being able to see and to do what I need to do. And he goes, to do that, I need to be outside. So I knew that's where he was when they called me.
June, your son Billy was killed on March 17th of this year. He was driving a Humvee when a roadside bomb exploded.
Yeah, I'm going to name some of the friends he was with. He was with Sergeant John Allen, 25, and he was with John L. Landry, Jr., which was 20, from Massachusetts. That was his best friend. And Sergeant Ed Santina, 25. They were in the vehicle together. They were going to help some friends who were in harm's way. And Billy was driving the Humvee, and they hit a roadside bombing, and they died instantly.
Did you and he talk about your concerns about him being in harm's way? And if you did, what would he say when you told him you were worried about him?
When Billy and I talked, I'd always tell him that God's with him, and reassure him that he could do what he had to set out to do. And he was always concerned about the children there. He had one little girl in particular that he was worried about. Her family was murdered in front of her. She was about 7 years old, and she reminded him of his daughter, Aries. When we got his camera back, which included 133 pictures, he had this little girl on there the whole time, pictures of her.
Adam did the same thing. His thing was if they could befriend the children and teach them they didn't have to be afraid of a U.S. soldier and that maybe these guys would be friends to them, that they wouldn't have to fight in the future.
This war is really only touching a small percentage of Americans because obviously there's no draft. It's a volunteer army. What would you each say to people who are listening about why your sons were serving?
For Adam, like I said, that's a real personal choice.
They have a calling.
Yeah, Adam wanting to be a police officer is, I always say it's not something you do, it's someone that you are. And they have this drive to try to help people, to try to make life better. The old adage, it sounds funny, but to make the world a better place, leave it a better place than when you got here. And not everyone is cut out for it. It obviously takes a strong mental person, and not everyone is cut out for that. But the people, like I said, the people of the United States need to know that, yes, they are our sons and our daughters, but they belong to all of us.
June, you said it was a calling.
It's a calling they have. Elfrida, she mentioned about her son having, what was it, a uniform or a cowboy outfit?
Yeah.
We put pictures up of Billy at the funeral, and we didn't realize until someone mentioned it that he had Army suits on since he was 6 years old. He was always in camouflage.
Arsu.
Yeah, it was like he was meant to go. And God, you know, he chooses just a handful of people to take, and I think, unfortunately, you know, it happened to be our sons. Some come back, some don't.
That's June Davis. Before her, Elfrida Plumendor, both lost sons in Iraq. We thought we'd turn some time over to them today, and we're going to do more of that after a break, here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with a Memorial Day conversation with two mothers who've lost sons in the war in Iraq. Here now is Alex Ashlock. Thought he'd just get a couple of their thoughts, but he soon realized these were stories that needed time to tell. June Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan, lost her son Billy on March 17th of this year. His second child was born just 2 weeks before Billy died. Elfrida Plumendor of Gresham, Oregon's son Adam wanted to come home and become a police officer. He was killed in February 2005.
It's been more than 2 years since he was killed.
Yes,
is it? I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to respond to this myself. But does it get any easier? Do you get comfort from anything in particular?
I wouldn't call it comfort exactly. If I'm having a really hard day, I go up to the cemetery. I go up there at least three times a week anyway, but sometimes I'm up there five or six in a week. I wouldn't say that it gets easier by any means, but what happens is I already know how I'm going to feel. It's not that I wake up and have something new. You just get accustomed to how your heart feels and how it hurts. But I don't think it gets any easier, no.
In June, Billy died only this year. What do you do? What brings you any sense of comfort, or if comfort is not the right word?
Right now, it's too early for me. I'm listening to her on the two years?
Yes.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd say something different because...
Sorry. I don't want to mislead you, at least.
No, I am. For me, it's a hole in my heart, you know?
And that's exactly what it's here. I think the more you love, the more it hurts. And
they asked me yesterday when they put a stone on his grave how I felt. And I said it's completion, but it's also a note to everyone there that this is a soldier lying here now, a soldier who fought for our country.
Right. They say everything's etched in stone. It's a permanent. And that's how I feel the hole in my heart is going to be. It's permanent.
The thing for me is going to see my son. You know, when I tell people I have to go see my child,
yeah,
they
don't understand, but I've taken a blanket and sat out there, and you know, sometimes you just sit and talk to them. Sometimes I just sit there and I look at the stone and I just sit there and try to absorb it all. Actually, and like I said, it's been 2 years for me. But
I do have something funny to say, if I can say it. Is that
sure?
Okay?
Yes.
I do landscaping, so my yard is pretty heavily full of plants and things. And my son always asked me, well, where are you going to plant the next tree? You have no more room. I went to his grave yesterday, and I went to go put a wind chime on it. And I almost heard him say, oh, Mom, please don't make my grave the way your yard looks. So, you know, I didn't do it.
Isn't it funny how you can hear their voice?
Yeah.
I used to think, oh, man, I'm kind of losing it when I could actually hear his voice in my head, but... no, it's true. You can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk to you. I at least I think they do. So
yeah, and I believe so.
Yeah. So it's kind of nice to remember their little chuckle and their laugh. And
out of curiosity, what was Adam's middle name?
J-A-Y.
It's so funny because we were going to name Billy Adam.
Really?
Yeah, and it was going to be Adam Nathan.
Oh, my goodness. Well, they sound so much alike. I mean, you
and Billy
know,
was
they, would have been,
be a,
they could Billy, have been friends if they knew each other, you know?
Yeah, and Billy was going to come home and be a police officer, too.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's when I heard you say that, it was like, you know, gee, it sounds just like him.
It's kind of like God wants specifics in his army, and that's the ones he's taken. So.
Yeah.
June, you've maybe in some ways already answered this question, and I want to ask Alfreda as well, and I'm sure you never imagined you'd even be hearing a question like this, but how would you like your son to be remembered?
With a wide smile. He had a smile from ear to ear every time he looked at someone, and everybody remembered him from that. He used to go to pick up his wife from work, and they always remembered him coming in with that big smile and grabbing his kids.
Alfreda, what about Adam?
Oh, gosh, he had so many facets of his personality. Like I said, you know, the care, the compassion, you know, the love of life, great sense of humor. Also had always a ready smile. Just, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, everybody seems to remember. The fact that he was a responsible person, stepped up to the plate. It didn't matter what it was. He would step up to the plate, get the job done, you know, take care of business, so to speak. But I would say, if I wanted people to remember one thing, it's that he was he's very much loved, missed. He always will be, and those of us that love him, a large piece of our hearts are missing, and. I just want people to remember that any soldier that we lose, there's a very loving family behind them.
I know I'm going to, I don't know if you've heard of Frankfort, Michigan.
Uh-uh.
they have a bluff there that you can climb, and it takes about an hour to climb it. And every year, Billy would always compete with me climbing this bluff, and he'd always go up it so fast, he'd get dizzy, and I'd have to bring him down. And now I can say this year, you know, he's at the top. He made it before me.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to climb it and get to the top.
Yep. And you won't have to worry about bringing him down.
No. He'll probably bring me down.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. They're never far from us. I don't think they're close.
Yeah.
June Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Elfrida Plumendore of Gresham, Oregon, their sons, were killed in Iraq. Billy Davis was killed in Baghdad on March 17th of this year. He was 26 years old and leaves behind a wife and two children. Adam Plumendore was killed in Mosul on February 16th, 2005. He was 22. Their mom spoke, with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. So young, it's Here and Now. On this Memorial Day, we thought we'd take some time to remember the military service of a man who is known for his career in a very different uniform.
Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is going, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams.
Announcer Kurt Gowdy calling it as Red Sox slugger Ted Williams hit a home run in his final at-bat at Fenway Park in September 1960. That's the Ted Williams that most people remember, the legendary hitter, the last man to bat 400 in a season, 521 career home runs. But that statistic is made even more impressive when you stop to think that it doesn't count the five seasons that Ted Williams, in his prime, didn't play professional baseball. Captain Ted Williams served in two wars, World War II and Korea. He was a flight instructor, flew 39 combat missions, walked away from a near-fatal plane crash, and was back in the cockpit the next day. Well, longtime Williams biographer Bill Nowlin looks at the military career of Williams in a new book, Ted Williams at War, and he joins us with more. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
And, you know, those of us who even briefly had the chance to meet and talk to Ted Williams know that your title is double entendre.
Yes, he was at war with certainly sports writers, newspaper folk, and he had a few stormy marriages.
Yeah.
There were people he did get along with, though. He never got in a fight with a major league umpire.
There you go.
Never once kicked out of a ball game.
Well, but as you write in your book, he could have avoided military service entirely. When he was drafted, he fought it because he was the sole supporter of his mother. He won that case and then enlisted.
He had also bought a 3-year annuity, and he had to keep the payments up, which he couldn't afford to do on a military salary. So he wanted to keep doing that so that his mother would be set for life. Mm-hmm. He also resisted the notion of other people telling him what to do.
So you can't draft me, I'm going to enlist.
Right. Basically, he made his point. He fought it, he did win, as you said, and then he toured the spring training sites and got a huge round of applause from the service people in the audience. Made his point, and then just one day, without even announcing it, except to one friend who covered it, he went in and signed up for the Navy.
Right. Now, put us in context at this time. Who is this Ted Williams who's first enlisting in the Navy?
At that point, he'd just finished the season in which he hit 406. That was 1941, and December 7th, Pearl Harbor. Mm. So just he hardly had time to enjoy it, and here he was, part of a whole country that was plunged into war.
He became a pilot in the Navy. Given his keen eyesight that also served him as a hitter, you know, that wasn't so surprising. Then he switched over to the Marine Corps, and that would be proved to be pivotal. As you write, he didn't serve in combat in World War II. He was a flight instructor. But he was called back into service for Korea April 1952. Now, this is a very different time in his life. Set the scene here. Who is Ted Williams at this point?
At this point, he was 34 years old, or turning 34 that fall. He had set all kinds of marks as a public figure. He'd already won the batting title several times. He was perhaps the most widely photographed man in America.
The highest paid player in baseball. And he became, looking through your book, which is a beautiful book, it's styled beautifully, he had to be the most photographed Marine.
It's very interesting because he could have gone the morale building route. He could have gone into special services and played ball, waved from platforms just to cheer the troops up and so forth. But he said no, he didn't want to go back. There's no question he didn't want to go back.
Did he think he was being exploited?
Yeah, he felt it was unfair. The Marine Corps had demobilized too many people after World War II. Had he been in the Navy Reserve, he would have not been called back. He believed that if he had not been such a public figure, they would have let him off one way or another.
Right. But, as you said, he decided to go the hard route.
Right. I wonder if he felt, having been in World War II but never seen combat, trained hundreds of other pilots to go fly, I wonder if he questioned his ability to measure up, what it would really be like. So he said, if I'm going, I want to fight. And so he became a dive bomber pilot flying Panther jets.
And saw a lot of combat. In fact, made a crash landing on his third mission, got out and got in another plane, went back up.
It was just about noontime that the plane crashed. At 8:08 the next morning, he was back on his base. Had to be ferried back, but he was up, just like getting back on a horse after you've been thrown.
The pictures throughout the book are fascinating. I mean, there he is serving with Johnny Pesky, but there he is with John Glenn, who later became an astronaut and senator. Ted Williams was wingman for John Glenn.
That's right. And John Glenn was extremely gracious to Ted, has been in some of his autobiographies. He said that Ted was his wingman for half the missions he flew in Korea, and he wouldn't have wanted anybody else to protect him on his wing. Mm. Well, that was somewhat of an exaggeration, but they did fly 8 missions together.
You know, I just had a moment of thinking what we would have lost. I mean, it's just a reminder that you never know who these soldiers, Marines, are going to become.
They both could have been shot down at the same time.
Right. You quote Glenn saying of Williams, he did a great job. He was a good pilot. Was he, in your estimation?
It's interesting. I talked to about 40 pilots that served with Ted in the 2 squadrons there and a couple of sister squadrons. Most of them agreed he was a good pilot, but not a great pilot. A couple people, I mean, he was a controversial guy, and even within the squadron, some people resented his fame and fortune.
He says, the two things I'm proudest of in my life is that I became a Marine pilot and that I became a member of baseball's Hall of Fame. I'm wondering how much the Marines is something that Ted Williams maybe really needed, someplace where at least someone would tell him what to do or tell him how to do it.
Well, as I mentioned before, he never got in a fight with a major league umpire. He also worked well in the hierarchy of the Marine Corps. He had commanding officers. He never had a serious disagreement with the commanding officer that popped out into and they had disagreements because he spoke up. And there was one guy that maybe recommended him for court-martial at one point, but kind of backed off.
Right. So it wasn't entirely submitting himself to, you know.
He spoke up, but he got along fine with people above him and below him. He was known, several of the enlisted men that I talked to said that he, as an officer, could buy alcohol and did for some of them. He didn't drink himself.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever again see a story like the Ted Williams story when it comes to his service in the military? I mean, we know that there is a parallel with former Arizona Cardinal Pat Tillman, who enlisted in the Army Rangers and was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan, of course.
Well, the people that came to mind to me were Alex Rodriguez and Barry Bonds, because they're two huge figures in the ballgame today. And it's just inconceivable that either of them would suddenly become, you know, a helicopter pilot in Iraq. That's kind of the equivalent, because Ted was one of the, with Joe DiMaggio and a couple of other people, he was one of the two or three biggest figures in the game at the time.
What do you think the Marines did for him, and what do you think he did for the Marines?
Certainly he helped them. He was a poster boy for the Marines, and there were some rumors that he'd cut a deal at the end of World War II that we won't call you back if you let us use you for publicity. Well, that may have been forgotten at some point along the way. But I think the Marine Corps did a great deal for him, and I, many times at the Ted Williams Museum annual events, his last 10 years or so, when the band would come in playing the Marine Corps hymn, he would struggle to stand up. He'd had a couple of strokes, and you could just see the pride in him.
Bill Nallen's new book is Ted Williams at War, a look at Williams' military service as a flight pilot in World Wars II and Korea. Bill, thanks so much for coming to tell us about it.
Thank you very much, Robin.
The Marine Corps Hymn as performed by the El Paso Wind Symphony. You're listening to Here and Now. The American Heritage magazine may soon be a thing of the past. Well, it already is a thing of the past, the American past, but it may now also be shutting down. When it was founded in 1954, it was an instant hit, a cloth-bound book with beautiful paintings on the cover, saved by subscribers right next to their National Geographics. The latest issue, a glossy magazine chock-a-block with ads and articles aimed at baby boomers. But the attempts to keep up with the times and the Newsweeks have failed. Owner Forbes, Inc. wants to sell the magazine, and publication has been suspended, though American Heritage will continue to maintain its website. Richard Snow is editor of American Heritage, and he joins us now from his office. Welcome.
Hello, Robin. Thank you.
Well, I'm so sorry about this.
Well, gee, me too, but we, you know, I can't help thinking that it's been a pretty wonderful ride. We did keep it afloat for 53 years.
And you were there for almost all of those.
I had a preposterously long career. I came there as a completely inept 17-year-old mailboy in the summer of 1965. As my wife said to me not entirely pleasantly the other day, gee, you clawed your way to the top in just 43 years.
And now this. Well, what do you think? Is this just another sign that the printed page is becoming a thing of the past, or is it a sign that history is becoming a thing of the past?
The ironic thing is now that people really do seem to be getting interested in history again. You know, you look at a successful entity like the History Channel, mm-hmm. why we're withering at that time, you know, it's always possible we're doing something wrong. It is, however, a very tough time for most magazines economically. We were always kind of a luxury buy with 350,000. You know, I'd be delighted to sell 350,000 of a novel if I wrote one.
Right. But, we should say your circulation is 350,000, high as it's ever been, although that doesn't compare to,
other
magazines.
It's not huge. And we were always sort of a luxury buy for advertisers. You said earlier it was chock-a-block with ads. I wish it were the case.
I'm looking at the current issue. And I have to say, I just thought I'd just thumb through it, and I couldn't. I had to stop at all these terrific articles. There's a fascinating piece on the manual that was handed out to American GIs in World War II on how to behave in Britain. Don't be a show-off. Never criticize the king and queen. Here's a piece on Benedict Arnold in upstate New York. Someone retraced his steps. Did he suffer psychological wounds because of his Connecticut childhood with an alcoholic father? You know, it's set in one of my favorite places, upstate New York, Saratoga, Lake Champlain. And I found myself pulled in, and I'm reading it, and I'm thinking, well, what's not to like here? Do you think it's the internet as well?
Well, you know, with the internet, people can absolutely pick and choose what their interests are. And if you want to read about Benedict Arnold's campaigns, you can spend a week on a website doing that as opposed to hoping it will crop up in an issue of American Heritage. That may account for part of it.
What about some of the criticism along the years that, yes, it helped popularize American history, especially when it was founded? It was, you know, really Civil War buffs in particular loved the magazine. It featured writers like David McCullough, who went on, of course, to be such a hugely popular author. But critics of that kind of popularization of American history, critics of writers like David McCullough, said that the American Heritage style was, you know, more nostalgia than history. You know this argument because you've been going back and forth in print with some of these critics, like historian Sean Wilentz at Princeton. You know, what do you think of his criticism, that this is just sort of pulpy nostalgia?
I think narrative history is a high and honorable tradition, and I think it would be hard to name one highly regarded historian who has not written for us in the past 50 years.
And we rush to say that one of our favorite historians, Boston University's Julian Zelitzer, who's heading to Princeton, actually, he says, you've done a great job of bridging the world of academics and general readership. He says your magazine did a nice job of trying to package and present important historical questions to readers who weren't experts.
Well, that's very heartening to hear.
A little late, maybe, but...
Well, that's okay. Welcome anytime.
Well, and what do you think is going to happen? I mean, will the website, do you think, be enough?
It's awful good. We started about 2 years ago. It was kind of a perfunctory joke. We just had it up because we had to have it. But over the past 2 years, it's grown to be, I think, as good a history website as can be found.
Well, Richard Snow, editor of American Heritage Magazine. It has suspended publication for now as its owner, Forbes, Inc., is looking for a buyer. By the way, if anyone's interested, get in touch with Richard. It'll still be, as we said, available on the web. You can link to their site by visiting ours, here-now.org. Richard, thanks very much for speaking to us about 50-odd years of history.
Thank you so much.
Okay, after the break, The Grateful Dead lives in the Dark Star Orchestra, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Come here. It's been 12 years since psychedelic rock icon Jerry Garcia died of a heart attack and ended the reign of the Grateful Dead as the world's largest grossing touring band. But the music of the Grateful Dead, the band Garcia co-founded, lives on in a group called Dark Star Orchestra. Even surviving members of the Grateful Dead say DSO, as they're called by fans, takes the Dead experience beyond the realm of cover band. Producer Doug Fine went to see for himself.
Donna Jean Godshaw McKay has just walked off stage at the Great American Music Hall here in San Francisco, the birthplace of the Grateful Dead. It's well after midnight, and the silver-haired diva, who was a vocalist with the Dead in the 1970s, has been sitting in with a Dead cover band. The reason, says Godshaw McKay, is simple. The Dark Star Orchestra, or DSO, is carrying the mantle for an intangible combination of musical experimentation, fan interaction, and cosmic serendipity that she calls unique.
The Dark Star Orchestra has really captured the vibe of the Grateful Dead, and obviously, you know, so many people still want that, and they still come to hear that. It's a real inheritance. You don't ever get over it. Because of that, it's going to keep going on and on and on, no matter who's on that stage and no matter who's doing it.
What the Dark Star Orchestra does is recreate, song for song, actual Grateful Dead shows. On this night, it's a performance from February 24th, 1974. Godshaw McKay was known for her passionate screams in songs like The Music Never Stopped and Playing in the Band. Here she is letting it rip on Playing in the Band with the Dead 33 years ago. Here's Donna singing the same song with DSO today. If you're a Deadhead and you can't tell the difference, you're not alone. Some Dark Star Orchestra fans, like Danny Clark, go so far as to call it channeling. Clark says he attended more than 200 Dead shows and now more than 20 DSO shows. He says at times he can be as moved by a performance now as when he saw the Dead decades ago.
See, it's an honest energy. Its intentions are good, and it draws on actual myth and folklore. And also, it's always fresh and new, such like the playing in the band we just heard. You never really knew where it was going to go or how long it's going to go.
That was a really long first set jam.
Yeah, it was really great. It was so good.
Fans at DSO shows include old-time Deadheads, now web designers and lawyers, and a new generation like 25-year-old wholesale bead and jewelry manager Lori Evans of Oakland, who was just 12 years old when Jerry Garcia died.
You look to me like you're probably too young to have actually seen a Dead show, is that right?
That's right.
So what is it that brings you to the Grateful Dead experience in the form of Dark Star Orchestra?
Oh, it's just so much fun. The music is wonderful, and everyone is such positive energy, and dancing is just so much fun.
How many Dark Star Orchestra shows have you seen?
Ooh, probably like 10 or 15 maybe.
From a stranger, Evans received a miracle ticket, that is, a free pass to tonight's sold-out show. This kind of thing happens all the time in the Deadhead scene. Indeed, there can be a mystical, even spiritual tone to conversations with Deadheads about Dead music and community. DSO rhythm guitarist Rob Eaton embraces the personal transformation known to happen to fans at Dead shows and now at Dark Star Orchestra shows.
It's important to me. I mean, for me, I mean, the music has been it's shaped my entire life. From the career paths that I chose to the places I chose to, I mean, for everything about my life has been really tooled completely around the Grateful Dead's music. So I'm as much into it as anybody else is that's out there. And I think the thing about the Grateful Dead that was so special was the community and what happened when the music was the catalyst to bring this energy together. And when that all connected, it was better than any drug you could ever take. And that's why you'd go to all the shows, not because you wanted to see every show. You didn't want to miss it when it happened because it was so good.
At least five former members of the Grateful Dead entourage, including the sound engineers and the Dead's official historian, are backstage at this slate of DSO shows in San Francisco. And four former members of the Dead have performed with DSO. Fans are starting to follow the band as far as Europe. It's no small feat to recreate the experience of an inherently improvisational band. DSO drummer Dino English says the group carries the torch with care.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a huge responsibility for sure, and I do feel that weight, you know, sometimes. But it's a responsibility that I am very proud to be able to be a part of, and, you know, playing my little part that I do. Really, this music will continue on, you know. The Grateful Dead was basically, we're a folk band, an electric folk band. And the definition of folk music is music that's passed down through the generations. After us, you know, it'll be passed down, I believe it. You know, somebody else will pick it up, and that energy will be there.
As badly as Deadheads new and old want the experience to, as the song goes, keep on truckin', it wouldn't work if DSO's music wasn't tight. Some fans even say a DSO performance can surpass an original Dead show in overall quality and energy. The Dead were known for widely variable performances, at least in part because of Jerry Garcia's health issues. DSO lead guitarist John Kadlicek, who manages to channel Jerry Garcia's cigarette-derived vocal inflections and trippy bluegrass-inspired guitar solos to a degree that converts thousands of skeptical Deadheads, says DSO's members benefit from listening to decades of Dead bootleg tapes.
We're also doing this thing where we're sort of providing for each other these cues to trigger memories of different things, you know. And it isn't necessarily the show we're doing, you know. And if we end up, you know, like actually having this subconscious exchange of phrases and licks from, you know, 30 years of their performances, actually.
DSO's Rob Eaton describes a Grateful Dead song as an empty canvas and DSO as painters that splatter the canvas as the mood hits them on a given night. And the fans? They just dance and, as the Dead lyric goes, listen to the music play.
Producer Doug Fine in San Francisco. For more on the DSO and the Grateful Dead, go to our website, here-now.org. And we leave you with a challenge. This is the Grateful Dead anthem, Jack Straw. But is it the version the Grateful Dead played on February 24th, 1974 in San Francisco? Or is it the Dark Star Orchestra playing the same song in the same city on March 28th, 2007? We're curious if you can tell. Send us a note at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. If you're on Long Island and happen to be going to the National Cemetery there, please stop by Grave 239B, Section V for me and spend a moment with former Marine Floyd Jones Youngs, Jr. And please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.